In it. Tonight's topic is how I saw it laid out was kind of a throw together lesson. You know, Tom had these extra demons, and he's like, "Yeah, I'll just put them all together." I didn't really see much of a pattern between them, besides they're demons and they got cast out. So, let's go to Mark. Mark chapter 21. This is still very early in the ministry of Christ. And Mark records for us, "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority, and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man who was with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, 'What have you to do with us, Jesus Christ? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God.' But Jesus rebuked him, saying, 'Be silent, and come out of him.' And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, 'What is this? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him.' And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding regions of Galilee." So here, to me, this would have fit better as a Sabbath healing, but unlike the Sabbath healing, where it was a physical ailment, this was more of a demonic healing. This one's interesting because if you turn over to Luke, where Luke records it, when you get down to the point of the unclean spirit, it's interesting because at first reading of Mark, it seems more like a question. But if you get over to Luke 31 through 37, starting verse 34, well, backing up in verse 33 to get the context back. "And in the synagogue there was a man who had a spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out with a loud voice, 'Ha, what have you to do with us?'" Now here we get more of a context that Mark kind of leaves out. Mark probably would have understood this in his writing to be this guy was mocking Jesus. Even though he says who Jesus was, he was still mocking him. So, it's interesting to note that in this, we have Jesus teaching on the Sabbath, and he's also teaching unlike what they've heard from their scribes before. And this astonished them. So, you have this guy who just walks into your synagogue. He teaches unlike what the scribes are teaching. This demonic guy comes up to him and says, "You know, what do you have to do with us? I know who you are." And Jesus rebukes him. Why would Jesus rebuke somebody who just called him the Holy One of God?
Jane? Well, it could be a number of reasons. One, the last person you want, being your cheerleader or your singing your praises.
Okay.
So that's one thought that he may not want these demons giving him glory. Also, he may there was a huge chess game that was going on between God and Satan, and there were certain things that Jesus had to push the religious leaders to a certain point. And if they were catching on that, hey, even the demons know this guy is the Son of God, it may not have worked out exactly the way that he wanted.
Okay. That's a good point. Like you were saying, it seems like the entire life of Christ is this big, long chess game, this big, long political back and forth of, okay, you think you're going to do this. You doing this thinks this is going to happen, but in reality, it's going to work like this. And I do agree. I think this is one of those times where bad publicity is not always good publicity, because I don't know if this man was recognized as one with the demon in the synagogue, but definitely if he's convulsing and crying out with a loud voice, he's not going to be the one who you're like, oh, he's a trustworthy man. You know, after he just got done failing on the floor like a fish, be like, oh, who do I want to trust? Do I want to trust the guy failing on the fish? Yeah, I'll take his word for it. So he kind of combats what Jesus did in the synagogue and coming in and teaching with authority, not like the scribes. See, Jesus just took a step forward, and then this demon kind of sideswiped him and said, oh, you're the Son of Man. Let me go flop on the floor and discredit myself, therefore discrediting what I just said, even though what he said was true. So moving on, we see that the Spirit does obey him, and the Jews act positively. This is interesting. I'm sure I've read this who knows how many times, but it just dawned on me today, hey, the Jews actually reacted positively to something Jesus did. And they were the ones spreading Jesus' name and spreading it in a good light rather than a bad light, as compared to the end of his ministry where they're slandering him and eventually crucifying him. So that was just something that kind of stuck in my head, being like, huh, that's interesting. So, Tim?
What happened in this situation that, you know, nothing was damaged because of nothing in the other situation, you know, there was a herd of swine, obviously probably a Gentile herd of swine because they Jews didn't eat pork, but still there was some property damage there with all the swine.
Right. And that's something with the next one, I think it's the demonic son, that you'll notice that nothing, like Tim says, nothing happens property-wise. Now, granted, this is before the swine, but still, nothing really happens. The demon just leaves him. And so obviously, if somebody's flailing on the ground and acting like a crazy person, and obviously just stops, you know something happened. So the Spirit knew who Jesus was by calling him out. But my question is, and we already talked about a little bit about how it was a bad rep, but why did Jesus want him to be silent? There's other times where Jesus doesn't want people to go out, especially after he heals somebody, be like, no, don't tell nobody. Just go and, like with the lepers, just go show yourself to the priest and be about your day. Don't tell anybody. Why in this case, besides the point Shane brought up, why you not want to do this? Greg?
I don't know if it has anything. You know, when he would perform miracles and feed them, he didn't want them to believe because and follow him because they were getting food. And here it says, you know, they were amazed because evil spirits obeyed. The fact that it was impressive to them that the evil spirits were doing it. He wanted them to believe not because of the evil spirits, not because they were being fed, but because of his words and his life, and that he was the Son of God, and that he did have authority from God. Maybe he wanted them to believe for the right reasons again.
All right.
Maybe it was too early in his ministry, too.
Jeremy?
Well, I guess the way I read it was that the demon is speaking to him in a kind of sarcastic and irreverent way. I mean, he says, ha, what have you to do with us? And, you know, he could be calling him the Holy One of God as kind of a taunt in some ways. And so Jesus is saying,
So even though he was telling what's true, the way he presented it made it seem discrediting.
Yeah, and I mean, the demon has no right to speak to the Holy One of God. It is the Holy One of God.
Right.
And so Jesus says, shut up and do what I tell you.
So you're saying that Jesus told him to be quiet from a respect aspect more so than what he was saying. Be like, you're a demon, you're under me, be quiet. It's a submission thing. Shane?
Well, and it may not have anything to do with what he was saying, per se. I mean, it may just be part of, you know, stop talking. You know, I mean, we don't know how, you know, obnoxious the, you know, the demon was at this point, but this was, you know, Jesus was ready for the demon to come out, and that could be part of, you know, showing that he has power over the demons. You know, stop talking and come out of the man. Just be silent. And so, you know, the demon is forced to stop talking and come out of the person. So it may just be part of him just showing his power over the demon to make him, you know, stop and come out, rather than, you know, whether he was praising God or taunting God or, you know, whatever it was that he was doing.
True. There's definitely more questions that I could bring up and ponder about this that the gospel writers didn't feel that was relevant for us. But you do have to take away the point that the Spirit knew who he was, whether he was mocking him or not. The Spirit knew that he was the Holy One. He obeyed Jesus by coming out, and Jesus' name was spread throughout Galilee, and his fame was growing. So, like Greg was pointing out, by him telling him to be quiet was, to me, two points. One, it wasn't his time to be fulfilled yet. And also, I think it was also, he just needed to be quiet because it wasn't his place to talk. Any other thoughts before we move on? All right, so we'll move to Mark 9. Verse 14. There we go. Mark 9, 14 through 20. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, and the scribes urging with them. And immediately... Am I on the right one? Yep. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And they asked him, "What are you arguing with me about?" And some from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I have brought my son to you, for he has the spirit that makes him mute. And whatever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? And how long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell to the ground, rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And when Jesus asked his father, "How long has it been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and to water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you to come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse. So most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast him out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." So we have this event. It's still pretty early in the ministry of Christ, and this is right after the Transfiguration. So this is after the second time that Jesus said, "This is my son," and tells Peter, "Listen to him." Peter just wanted to build an altar for Elijah, Moses, and Jesus. And God basically rebukes him and says, "No, this is my son, listen to him." And then Jesus is the only one standing. So then immediately next, we see that this boy is brought to Jesus, and Jesus is out. It's probably the next day. And we have this boy who is filled with the Spirit. And this is not filled with the Spirit in a good way. This is a demon that is trying to kill the object he is in control over. He is, as we read, he is throwing him into the fires, he's throwing him into waters, he's convulsing, he's making him rigid, foaming at the mouth. Not pleasant things that you want to experience. The interesting thing to me is the father brought him to the disciples first. So here, if you can deduct from this passage, the apostles had some form of way to get rid of demons. They had some kind of power to get rid of these demons and to try to do it, and to a point that people were coming to them to get rid of demons. And so you see this father, he's so distraught, he sees a son who is obviously controlled by something more than himself, who is causing him harm, and he's taken it to everybody he knows, and he runs and he sees Jesus. And he sees this man, and he's probably heard multiple things about him, and he says, "Please heal my son." And this is something that I find interesting. Well, not interesting at this point, but the next point that Jesus makes. He answers the question by a statement saying, or really a question, but calling them, "O faithless generation." Why would Jesus, who sees his father obviously distraught over his son, and says, "Please help my son," why would he answer, "O faithless generation"? Tim? Okay. Okay. Jay?
I've always read it to be more of that the apostles did not have the faith.
Okay. Every time I've heard this, it's been leading more towards that. Now I can understand your point, Tim, of it could be the father's point. But I've always heard it taught on the point of it's the disciples are the ones that didn't have the faith. Or it was the crowd that was around him, the Israelites, they were the ones without the faith. And at this point, Jesus isn't really talking to the Father, but he has turned his attention to the crowd, and he's, in a sense, rebuking the crowd, saying, "You faithless generation." And he says, "How long am I going to be with you? And how long do I have to bear with you?" To me, he answers the Father's question with rebuking. I don't think Jesus likes to answer questions because he doesn't really answer questions. You ask him a question, he either rebukes you or rebukes the crowd or does something else. He doesn't answer your question. But in a sense, he does answer your question or does tell you what you need to know, whether it was your question or not. But he says this thing as a, and he tells us later, this is not something that can be driven out by prayer. It seems like it almost frustrates him. He's like, "Well, why didn't you just pray about it? You know, you faithless generation." Going back to the sense of you're not following God, you're not bringing things to God in prayer, which ultimately leads to your faith. If you have no faith, you won't bring anything to God. And this is something that can be taken out by God. Obviously, you're not, Tim.
Just, it's an amazing reinforcement of
And where am I at? I think I went too far. Anyways, so the Father here, it seems like Jesus in verse 19 is rebuking the crowd or rebuking the apostles who are in the crowd. And then he turns back to the Father and you kind of see the compassion of Christ again. You see how long has this been happening? And kind of gets the background story. You know, he's in this point, he's kind of like a doctor. Okay, when did this start? What's happening? What's going on? Not like Jesus didn't know, and not like Jesus had to know to fix them. But it was one of those compassion endearing type things where Jesus was like, okay, tell me. Yes, sir.
We've studied a little bit of this too recently, and I wonder too if the generation that he's really referring to isn't possibly this whole Jewish generation that has gotten to the point where they no longer trust in God's power. They've he asked me the question, how long has this kid been this way? And the kid's been that way since he was little. Why hasn't he had him to the priest, and why haven't they been offering prayers in his behalf? You go back in the Old Testament, you see where they had provision for these things to help.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, instead of that, he's going to people to try to find people that can fix this thing instead of going to God. And I believe that's where the people lost their way. They started putting more faith in physical things here, and they really forgot to go to God for this help. And they had provision under the old laws.
Right.
And I think they bypassed that situation. Because he put up with it for a long time, but they like he didn't have enough faith. But the whole system, it may very well have been that the priest didn't take it seriously and try to help him stuff. So I think the whole problem had gotten very out of hand.
Mm-hmm. And when the Israelites came back from captivity, they never followed an idol per se. They never said, okay, this is the idol, this is what idol we worship. But that doesn't mean they didn't have anything between them and God, and them and their worshiping God. And lots of times their traditions and their own personality, or not personality, but their own persona of themselves, their own status became their idol. It wasn't a manifested idol, but it definitely was an idol. And here, you kind of get all these different things where you're just like, okay, could it be this, could it be this, could it be this? And more than likely, it's a combination of everything. You have this generation after generation after generation that's slowly building this separation between themselves and God, that they're not trusting the priest, or the priests don't trust in the power that they have through the power of prayer. But you get to Christ, and it seems like they're just walking through the motions, and them being called a faithless generation, you have to believe it's true. Because what they do and what they act and how they go about things, you're like, they have no faith. They say they do. They act like they do. But really, when it boils down to situations like this, you're like, okay, if it only took prayer, why did it get this long? If I'm sick and all it takes for me to get a prayer, why would I go to the doctor? Why would I live with it for years when I just be like, hey God, I got a cold. Oh, thanks. If that's all it takes, and it seems to, with Jesus' power, as it's shown, he commanded it to come out, it comes out, why wouldn't they? And it seems like they've lost that disconnect, lost their trust in God, lost their faith in God. So we go down in verse 22, we'll get at the second half. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. This is the Father talking to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, in verse 23, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. And then the child acts up again. And Jesus saw that the crowd was running towards him. He rebuked the unclean spirit. So I see this little situation where there's crowds around him. It's kind of like a marketplace. People are just wherever. But they're seeing what's happening, but they're not really, it's not like it's a stage scenario. And then the child starts flaring, and everyone just flocks to him. They're like, okay, something's about to happen. Something has got to happen. You've got the child flying around. He's probably got a demon. Here's Jesus. Let's see what Jesus does. It's like feeding the 5,000. Oh, It's lunchtime. Okay, let's see what you're going to... Oh, food. Next day. Oh, Jesus had food for us yesterday. Let's have food today. So we see this crowd just coming, running towards them. And Jesus rebukes the spirit, saying, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him and never enter him again." This is something that it always amazes me that we could have these problems and Jesus can just say something and it happens. Creation is always one of those things that just marvels at me. Jesus is like, "Oh, let there be light." Or God says, "Let there be light." Boom, light. And I'm like, how is that even possible? It's just one of those marvels of God that always gets me. Yes, ma'am.
I think about like the reaction of the kids that it's like they're trying to get prayer. We ask him something and like we're still doubting. If you can, Lord, do this.
Right.
But
and that's a very humbling statement, because here we have this man who he believes, but he doesn't think that he believes enough for this to happen. And he's looking to Jesus, "I believe, but help my unbelief. Help me when I falter. You know, help me where I'm not so sure about this." And I think that's an attitude that we can encompass ourselves, our daily walk will be much easier, because that forces you to take, "Okay, Jesus, I believe in you. I don't know how this is going to happen, how this is going to work, but I believe. You know, help my unbelief where I don't know how this is going to happen. And I'm still trying to linger to make it happen myself and make it myself try to twist the situation and make it work." And this man just kind of says, "Okay, Jesus, I believe, help my unbelief. You know, I completely trust you. You know, I'm trying to trust you. And I'll just put it into Jesus' hands." And immediately following that, he commands them to leave. And that attitude is an attitude that I try to think about every day, because sometimes in life, something's happening and then something else just happens and you don't know how to get back to where you need to be. And you're just like, "I think this is what I'm supposed to do." And sometimes when people try to manipulate their way back into situations and say, "Oh, I can do this," and they just plunge home, they sometimes end up worse than they already are. It's always interesting to look throughout history and look at all the nations that says, "I'm going to do it my way. I don't care what happens. Things are going to work out the way I want them to happen." And they don't. And then you have it over and over and over and over and over again. But when people say, "I'm putting my trust into God, and I'm going to let God take care," it happens just like here. Tim? As we move on, as my time is running away, in Luke it says that all the people were astonished at the majesty of God. We'll skip over that right now because I am running out of time. But here it's another situation where Jesus pulled out a demon and people reacted positively. So, any questions on this before me? Yes.
I just wanted to point out that I think there's something rather significant in verses 26 and 27, the fact that the boy was said to look as if he was dead, and then Jesus took him by the hand and raised him.
Mm-hmm.
This happening right after the transfiguration. And
yeah.
Him telling Peter, James, and John that he was going to be raised from the dead.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? All right. So, Luke 11. Luke 11, verse 14. Here we have, right after the Lord's Prayer. Now he was casting out demons. That was mute. Is that right? Yeah. Now he was casting out demons. That was mute. When the demon had gone... When demon had gone out, the mute man spoke, and the people marveled. So, here we have Jesus casting out demons. Mute man comes out. He sends the demon out. Man speaks. Verse 15. But some of them said, he casts out demons by Beelzebub, the prince of demons, while others, to test him, kept seeking from him a sign of heaven. But he, knowing their thoughts, said to them, every kingdom divided against itself is laid waste. A divided house falls. And if Satan also is divided against himself, how will his kingdom stand? For you say that I cast out demons by Beelzebub. And if I cast out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they will be judges. But if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. When a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are safe. But when one stronger than he attacks him and overcomes him, he takes away his armors in which he entrusted and divides his spoil. Whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. So here we have Jesus cast out a demon that was causing a man to be mute. The man could not talk. Luke doesn't really go into much detail about the man or the situation because he's trying to get to the point in which where Jesus talks about in verse 17. To me, Jesus casting out this demon was more of a, here's the setting for what Jesus is about to say. So he does cast out this demon. The demon does speak. But what happens next is, it's an interesting, they're like, oh, he's casting it out by Beelzebub. He's casting it out by Satan. And then others are like, oh, this is from heaven. And so his next point is a kingdom cannot stand if it's divided. We know this to be true almost everywhere. You take a union, you split them on an issue that they don't want to come back together on, to see how long that union's going to last. More than likely, it's going to split. This is obviously a principle that was already in place because Jesus brings this up as a point saying, kingdom that divides against itself cannot stand. So, when he brings that up, against Satan, how can Satan's kingdom stand if the point of Satan's demons is to act against God and make people distrust in God? But Jesus just cast one out. This is a kind of interesting statement by Jesus because he understands their hearts, he understands what they're thinking, and he just plainly starts rebuking them without them even saying anything. They're like, okay, here we have this demon. He's causing bad. He's obviously working for Satan. If I cast him out, that person is no longer under the control of Satan. How if I'm working for Satan, pulling somebody who's doing what Satan wants them to do, how is that working for Satan? And this is his basic argument. It's simple, but yet they didn't think about it. You know, it's like, you know, line up. Yes, sir.
It kind of goes back here when he said, if I can cast him out by demons, who is it that your sons cast him out? I think that's a reference back to the priesthood, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, if they had this ability, they had this prayer to God, they had an ability to work on these things and stuff, and they've gotten away from that because they lost their faith in God.
Right. And I kind of feel the frustration in Jesus because he's like, okay, guys, I'm trying to do something good here. Well, why do you think I'm from Satan? And it's like, Jesus, like, it's painfully obviously that I'm not from Satan. Why would I be hurting my own cause? If I was from Satan, why would I not want to cause destruction, which is ultimately Satan's goal? He moves then to the positive aspect of this rebuke, if you consider it a positive aspect. But he says in verse 20, but if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. Here's an interesting statement that Jesus comes out and says. If it's from Satan, Satan is basically destroying his own kingdom because he has two parties of his own people ripping it apart. But if he says it's from the finger of God, which is the flip side, obviously the kingdom of God is upon them. Basically, if it's not Satan, which it's the stupid battle plan, if it is, that's never going to work. Or it's this good thing that Jesus, that God has sent his kingdom to come to this earth. Jeremy, do you have a point?
Well, I wasn't raising my hand, but actually... it's interesting that the only other time I know of that the phrase the finger of God is used is in the plagues of Egypt. It's the third plague where the magicians of Pharaoh finally give up and say, this is by the finger of God. We can't reproduce this with our magical arts. And I guess the point I would make from that is it's interesting when you look at the Old Testament, and this is something that I didn't catch on to for a while, but when you look at the Old Testament, God's not just performing miracles left and right all the time. When miracles came, it was a new, like, epic of history, or God, you know, Elijah is coming and he's performing miracles. There's a new message from God. There's a new something happening from God when miracles come. It's not an everyday occurrence.
Right.
And so I think part of the point maybe of Jesus is, look, you need to be listening for the message. Because the works of God are among you, God is reaching out to you with a new message and a new era coming upon you.
And as we're waiting for the class to come out, Jesus' argument ends on a great one. That he says that this strong-armed man is here. And I think he's talking about Satan. Satan is here. He's fortified. He's got his stuff. When a stronger man comes in, he's going to take over. He's going to divide up his lands. Basically, when Jesus comes in and his kingdom will rule, when he completely rules, he will cast out Satan and he will disperse all his people. But let's not forget verse 23. Where Jesus says, whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. So basically, you don't have to be on Satan's side to not be with Christ. By not doing anything, you're not with Christ. So, thanks for all the comments.